From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Prime Minister has revealed a £14 billion boost for education in England over the next 3 years. Every secondary school will receive at least £5,000 per pupil next year, with every primary getting a minimum of £4,000 for each child the year after. Mr Johnson also says more measures, including reforms to teachers' salaries, will be announced tomorrow.
It's not just that it should go to classrooms, but I want to see teachers properly compensated for their fantastic efforts that they make. Teachers are vital for our country, and they need to be, the whole thing needs to be properly funded.
Labour reckons the cash doesn't cover cuts to education made by Conservative governments. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson thinks opponents of his plan to suspend the House of Commons in the run-up to Brexit are harming the UK's chances of getting a good deal. Jeremy Corbyn says the PM needs to understand that in our democracy, the government has to answer to Parliament. Damage adding up to around £2 million has been caused by a fire at the Whirlpool UK headquarters in Peterborough. Five teenagers aged between 15 and 19 have been arrested. Cancer Research UK says women should think carefully about going on hormone replacement therapy following a study into its links with breast cancer. It's found those using it have twice the risk of getting the disease as previously thought. It says the likelihood persists for more than a decade after usage stops. Caris Betts is from the charity.
Only 1% of all cancer cases in the UK are caused by taking HRT. And HRT is a really effective treatment for symptoms of the menopause. So women taking HRT, or women who are thinking about HRT, should talk to their doctor if they have any concerns to work out what's the right thing for them.
iPhone users are being advised to check their phone is running the most up-to-date operating system. Earlier, Google said hackers have been monitoring some of the Apple devices, gathering information for years. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hot Wells and Harbourside Mark Wright and independent former Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Israel at war with Lebanon, Iraq and Syria, without actually declaring war on any of those three, where will it end? Is a provocation against Iran now inevitable? And Epstein, who was he working for, Israel or China? We hear about the mysterious Humpty Dumpty Institute with congressmen and three Chinese nationals on the board, which nobody wants to talk about. Our New York City correspondent Kenyon Gibson has been delving into that one. Plus, a new series on superbrains, those the mainstream media refuse to acknowledge and try to bury. Tonight, a guy called Norman Dodd looks at foundation funding of education in the 20th century. And mental illness at Hinckley C, we brushed over last week. Could that be because the project they're working on at Hinckley is never going to be built? Especially with the Chinese money and the situation in Hong Kong. But like the Emperor's new clothes, maybe no one wants to talk about that. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 14 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20. Light showers tomorrow, sunny spells on Sunday. Next week, highs around 18. Sunny spells and light showers through the week. Next weekend, the 7th and 8th of September, highs of 18 Celsius, sunny spells, and a few fleeting showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hot Wells and Harbourside, Mark Wright, and independent former mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Okay, first of all, George, we got you on particularly to talk about the Western Harbour, and you as well, Mark, because it's part of your area, isn't it? What is happening? What's the latest? As a local councillor, hopefully someone has told you something.
Well, it's taken quite a while, but finally, after a year and a half, the mayor has brought forward his three options for public comment, which he's got a big vision for the area to totally transform the area. And they're dependent on the reorganisation of the road system, which everybody knows down there is a sort of a spaghetti dual carriageway.
Aren't there really four options? Isn't he saying, actually, we can do none of this and just spend £40 million repairing the old road system?
That's right. That is an option. I mean, the Arup consultants were told to go away and look at every option and come back. They presented 12 options, I think it was, to the mayor, of which he's brought forward his favourite three. But he has deliberately left out a very plausible option, which a lot of people are calling the fourth option, which is a sort of lower impact option of repairing the existing bridge, taking down some old off and on ramps, cleaning up the area a bit, and freeing up area for lots of development. It's much, much cheaper than the other options. It's lower impact, probably better environmentally, but it's been discounted by the mayor, and I've asked the council for them to include that fourth option in the consultation. They've said no. The justification is that it's not transformative enough.
Okay, well, what does that mean?
I have no idea. I mean, to be fair, I don't think anyone really knows, because it's the mayor's subjective decision on what he considers to be transformative. I mean, it's not a serious metric to be measuring something which excludes an option, in my opinion. I think the public deserve to be able to see that as a realistic option and to be able to comment on it.
So it's actually not the people of Hot Wells or Planning for Real or anything, one of these sort of systems whereby you get local opinions to decide. What's happened is an enormous civil engineering company has come and said, here are 12 options. The mayor has then picked out his favourite three from those. This doesn't really sound to me, George, like the way to do things. It's a very much top-down rather than bottom-up. And I understand that these development plans were mooted, actually even before your time, back in 2010 by Business West. Am I right?
Well, that's true. There was a book called High in Hope, Bristol 2050, published by the Chamber of Commerce Business West, written by John Savage, and that was looking at strategic options for that part of the harbour. But my concern is that we're wasting loads of people's money and time chasing something that is not going to happen, and we should be looking much, much more strategically. We should be looking strategically at how we deal with the huge threat that Bristol has in the future for flooding. We should use that, the solution to that, which part of which is likely to be a barrage at Avonmouth, downriver of the M5 bridge, over which there could be a crossing that relieves the M5 when it's blocked. And part of the reason for Cumberland Basin and for the major route down the Portway, which is very destructive environmentally, is because Highways England requires this alternative. This has not been aired at all in this consultation. Anybody looking at this logically should first highlight the bigger strategic issues. How do we relieve the motorway when it's blocked? Not taking it all right into the historic heart of the harbour and Bristol, but dealing with it much closer to where the problem lies. And so whether there is a solution, as I've described or not, it is madness to spend time on alternatives. By the way, there are six or seven other options that have been hidden that we're not able to see. And Mark is absolutely dead right. When I was mayor, I was I addressed the issue of the danger of the bridge breaking down. It is a real issue, and we spent quite a lot of money in terms of mechanical repair to it. And I was informed that it would be about something under 20 million to repair the structure and the
proper long-term repair?
Yeah, to do a proper long-term repair. That somehow has doubled to 40 million. I think that's just a frightener to get people to sit up. But actually, that is nothing in comparison to the hundreds of millions we're talking about with either of these three options. So I think the option of building a highway alongside the southwest bank of the Avon underneath the suspension, well, not right underneath, but in the foreground of that classic view of the suspension bridge, and then a highway bridge, another swing bridge, to replace the existing one, halfway between the existing bridge and the suspension bridge, is utter madness. I mean, Bristol will be a laughingstock with the national media if we come up with such an idiotic solution.
Well, I mean, actually, something similar did happen, I believe, or it was planned in the 1970s or 1980s, wasn't it, with a car park stuck on the side of the Avon Gorge.
It was a car park with a hotel on top.
Remind us about that, because that was that actually, it was corrupt people within Bristol City Council that approved the planning permission, and they had to bring in central government to say, no, you can't do this. Yeah. You can't ruin your city. Because, of course, you know, one does suspect things like backhanders, but often it's not that. It's just personal relationships. People will approve planning consent because they've been closely lobbied by the people that want that planning.
I don't, for a minute, expect there are backhanders. And I think it's just sheer idiocy. And it is seduction.
People
are seduced by developers. And it's very easy to get too cozy with developers. And I'm an architect. I know what goes on. And I think that it is, you've got to put up a certain amount of a barrier between yourself and developers when you're in a position of authority.
But if Marvin was here, George, he'd say, well, at least I'm getting something done.
Well, he's
George,
not.
George did nothing.
Well, he's not.
He is. He's moving things towards something happening. Now we've got a concrete consultation for something specific, which you didn't do.
Well, what he's doing is saying, oh, well, I want these big legacies. I've never, ever said that. I said we wanted legacies to us being European Green Capital. I never wanted legacies of my own. And he said, well, we want these big legacies, and we'll have an underground, which will cost hundreds of millions of pounds, and we'll have Western Harbour, which costs hundreds of millions of pounds. They're unachievable. They won't happen. And what has been achieved? I've been staying out of this largely for the past 2.5, 3 years, more than 3 years now. But I'm getting extremely agitated by the fact that I was blamed for anything that didn't happen, but nothing is happening. And people stop me in the street all the time saying, will you stand again? No, I won't. But, whether you agreed with me or not, I did make things happen. Now, there seems to be now we have... We've returned to the old party political situation where it's all about being re-elected rather than making a better city. And I think these are just pies in the sky that will be aired in an election, but they're spending money on stuff that won't happen, and it is a complete waste of time, but a dangerous waste.
Well, I wonder if the Western Harbour will end up being a bit like Hinckley Sea. Lots of effort spent on it, but finally nothing may be happening. Anyway, let's have a listen to the Mayor, Marvin Rees, now. He refuses to come on this show to talk about anything, let alone the Western Harbour, but he did come onto the relatively safe space at the BBC breakfast show about 10 days ago, and spoke to Emma Britton, really selling this whole Western Harbour plan.
I just think this is fantastic news for the city. When we came in, we inherited a scheme that was, you know, people were raising this with us because the city had been talking about it for a long time. I've been going around this part of the city, obviously, for a long time. My nursery school used to be there. It's plastered over in 1960s flyovers. This is not a live part of the city, right at the edge of the gorge with a view up. This is fantastic, and we have a configuration of things coming together at the moment. We're facing a £40 million bill to fix the bridge. Yeah, well, this is a feedback session. If people would like to just say, well, let's just spend £40 million and fix the mechanism on the bridge and keep everything as it is down there, then people can share that. But what we're talking about is a better future for the city. Bringing forward what would be one of the most exciting parts of the city. City centre living, a 7-minute bike ride, 25-minute walk on a metro bus stop so people can travel into work in the middle of the city when we're talking about the need to tackle our climate crisis. It's a very underused part of the city in some sense in terms of just being concreted over and lost to Bristol. We have an opportunity to introduce flood defences down there at the same time, which we need to do as well. And this is something that has been talked about for so many years in Bristol, and now it's actually happening. So now's the time just to join that conversation and help set out that vision for the city. And this is something that's pushed out. There's no global conspiracy here. This is about a 1960s road network and a swing bridge that periodically breaks and locks the traffic, and we're facing a £40 million bill to fix it. Rather than spending £40 million to sustain a 1960s road network that is anti-pedestrian, this is not good for the city's brand and image as well. This is just about saying, well, look, can we put it to something productive? Bring forward new communities, develop that part of the city, introduce our flood defences, have a travel to work area in which people can walk and cycle and carry by ferry boat. I mean, there really is no conspiracy. It's literally about doing something good in Bristol. Well, there's a consequence, but I'm not seeing any need to demolish existing homes within that. It's about reworking the road network so that we can bring forward land for more homes.
Yeah, I mean, the mayor has made some reasonable points, which is that it's a bit ugly down there at the moment, which is obviously true. I mean, there are lots of flyovers, of course. The reason for that is because it's a river and a harbour, and you want to get over them. What he hasn't mentioned is two key things. The first is that the fourth option that I'm talking about is not just fixing the bridge and then walking away. There have been ideas around for over 15 years about how that whole area now... There are too many roads down there. It was designed to be able to maintain full rush hour flow during a bridge swing, and that is not a necessary use case anymore. So a lot of those often on ramps and slip roads and back roads, they can all be taken out. They can be freed up, they can be parked, they can be green space, or they can be housing, whatever we want to put there. The other issue is that, of course, he doesn't mention what the downsides of the big vision plans that he's got. The downsides of the one up the western side of the harbour there is building a great big bridge right through one of the most iconic views in the entire country, and which, as George has already pointed out, will almost certainly be blocked by the government on those grounds. The downside to the eastern route that he's proposed is driving a four-lane highway right through the middle of an existing community on the edge of Spike Island. Now, that is a downside in itself. So...
And he said there won't be any homes demolished at all.
I mean, that may be true. I mean, it is possible to wiggle that four-lane highway a little bit. I'm a bit suspicious about that, because if you look at where that
maybe you
road...
could build it out on trestles a bit as well.
Yeah, but they're blighted. They may not be demolished. Yeah. They are dangerously blighted. Yeah.
I mean. That community there, if you build a four-lane highway right outside, people's front doors, you're effectively wrecking that community that's there. So, I mean, there is a solution which he is not allowing people to comment on, and he's not allowing people to see.
Now, I understand some of the plans have been quite secret up till now. You apparently were allowed to see them, Mark, but you weren't allowed to take any photos with your phone. I don't know if you managed to sneak any with your phone. what was all that about? And why such secrecy? But what happened to you?
Yeah, so this is the recent ARUP report, which goes over these dozen options, and it's been brewing for a year and a half. We've known that it has existed for a year and a half, and then it's been worked up. And it is the holy grail of all this, because it has all the information on all these different options. And I and a local group called the Cumberland Basin Stakeholders Group have been calling and requesting to see this report for a long time. And of course, the reason we couldn't see it for a long time was because it wasn't quite finished. And then it was finished 6 months ago, and we've not been allowed to see it since. Freedom of information requests have gone in, have been rejected by the council. There's an outstanding appeal with the Independent Information Commissioner on that. Now, the council doesn't want to alarm people. This is the reason why the public are not allowed to see it. They don't want to alarm people. In the end, I was allowed in along with the chair of the Development Scrutiny Committee. We were allowed to see a presentation on this document, and I had a bit of pen and a bit of paper, which was what I took down a page of notes on what I was able to see, which is why I was able to see that this fourth option was a serious option and a real goer that should be put in front of the people. Other members of other members of other parties have said that they have never seen a situation whereby a planning paper from a consultant has been kept so secret, even from scrutiny committees. They've never seen anything like this in the past.
Because there are answers that they don't want to happen, like the one you mentioned.
Well, actually, Emma did ask on BBC, did ask Marvin about this whole secrecy business.
earlier on, there's a bit of a narrative here about it not being released. I mean, I was out walking around, as actually was said earlier on.
You knocked on someone's door.
I was walking around Hot Wells, just meeting people randomly myself, over a year ago, and talking about this and many other issues as well, because there are many issues and opportunities and challenges facing people in Bristol. So we've been talking about this. The book Bristol 2050 High in Hope also had this in it as well, but now this is about making it real and trying to get stuff done in Bristol.
So what Marvin's saying there, George, is that he's actually walked around Hot Wells and spoken to people about it, so it's not secret.
Yeah, anyway, we'll pass by that. I would like to say that I don't believe it's the consultants' fault. I think the consultants have been asked the wrong question. And, the answers you get are the answers you want if you ask certain questions. But this idea of concealing the sensible solutions, I mean, I was vaguely involved with the adaptive solution years and years ago with one of the senior directors of ARUPS who came up with that scheme that Mark described. And it does produce quite a lot of new housing, but in a much more civilized way, in a way that leaves the grandeur of the bonded warehouses there. What there is a scheme that was brought to my office that I chucked out was a scheme that built up to the full height of all the bonded warehouses, in front of them and around them and between them, to create a sort of ugly city in the view of Clifton. Now, you could say, well, Clifton's a privileged place and they don't deserve a view. Clifton and that whole area and the area around the south there is absolute treasure that belongs to the whole of Bristol, look, and the whole of the UK.
There is parkland, which is possibly threatened by some of these options.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is that we do want something there. I mean, how would you do it, George, as an architect, if you were to sit down there with a blank sheet of paper and look at this and actually to actually bring local people on board? How should this be done?
Well, bringing local people on board is an absolute essential thing. So you need to go through the whole story with them rather than just chuck solutions at them. And the solution I will try and describe is that you take away some of the spaghetti that is on the south of the river, that releases on the south side of Cumberland Basin. That actually releases some very nice sites for building streets and squares and spaces and views that are intermingled with the bonded warehouses.
But you build high?
And you can
Do you build high? Do you have parks
You don't build high, but you make proper urban, proper urban stuff. But I think there is a madness about building high around many parts of Bristol, which seems to be getting more and more accepted. But it's I think it's very dangerous. I think Bristol has a particular character that we should keep. You can still build dense development. You look at the Wapping Wharf development. I think that what's happened there around Jail Ferry is it's highly dense development, but it's very civilized in the way it's done, and people love it, and it goes up to a maximum of 7 stories. And I think that we need to look more intelligently at it rather than just thinking high is good, which seems to be the general message.
Also, Marvin is absolutely clear this is going to happen. You're saying it's not.
Oh, I don't think it'll happen in the form it's happening. Now, the other thing on the Hotwell side of the bridge, I believe that you can stop the traffic pouring off the bridge down into Dowry Square. That has become a very, very intrusive highway since the 60s. Been a very, very intrusive highway. We can be much more intelligent in our adaptation. We need to massively reduce the amount of traffic pouring into the city anyway. We have a policy to go carbon neutral by 2030. I think it's a very brave policy. But if we're serious about that, we have to change the way we do things. And this is assuming we carry on doing things in the same way. So I think Marvin is being disingenuous talking about this being a green project. It's far from that. It is a gas-guzzling project, and it's a very intrusive one that it cannot in any way pretend to be on the back of an environmental agenda.
I mean, also on this part of this report, they've said, oh, well, actually, any option of tunnelling under there is not going to work. The substrata, the geology is just not right. So where does that leave the underground? Anyway, we'll hear from Mark again in a minute, but first let's hear a final clip from Marvin Rees, the Labour Mayor of Bristol, talking about this Western Harbour project on the BBC 10 days or so ago. And here he talks about who's going to pay for it, amongst other things.
Part of the design would be to make sure the harbour is brought back into life. And actually, this is about bringing more life to the harbour. And you'll see that what's being put out as well is absolute openness about the strengths and the weaknesses of all the options, because every option has strengths and every option has weaknesses, the West, the East and the hybrid, as does keeping it as it is. But I think this is another chance. We've got cranes on the horizon in the city now because they're getting things done. This is another chance to really grab our city by the scruff of the neck and begin to turn it into the place that we're really proud of. And that entranceway, in and of itself, I don't think is a grand entry to Bristol, but I think that we can deliver that kind of scale of ambition, but also tackle our housing crisis, our affordable housing crisis, the climate crisis we're facing, the flood defences we need to bring through. We can all do this at the same time.
Final question, who would pay for it? Regardless of what option, who would pay for it?
Well, that would be a mix with all these major developments. They're a mix of schemes. We don't dip into our pocket and take it out. We have different budget lines anyway and take it out. We look for investors. And that's one of the reasons we do talk internationally, because to get the hundreds of millions of pounds coming through, you do need to develop schemes like this. You have to talk to international investors. So undoubtedly, there'd be some national government support. But when we're building the homes, those would be, developers coming in to work with us. There are actually going to be 8 drop-in sessions coming up. So people should monitor the website and come and join that conversation and help shape the future.
Well, I'll put a link up to the drop-in sessions, whichever ones are left, up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. But Mark, he's making reiterating this point that someone's got to do something. We need more housing. This is a great place to put it. There is space there for it. And people would be able to cycle and even walk into work in town.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that is true also of many of the less intrusive options. And in fact, the less intrusive options are more likely to happen because they cost less and they have fewer downsides. Therefore, if he really wants to crack on and get this done sooner rather than later, the way to do that is not to imagine schemes that will lead to government intervention to try and block them because they're going to wreck the Avon Gorge. The way to do it is to deliver a scheme which is pretty feasible to do for, a fraction of the cost and will upset far less people and still delivers some new ground to open up and build flats and houses on.
Affordable housing, George, this one always comes up. It's not really affordable even though, is it? I mean, how what is this going to do for poorer people in the city? I would imagine not a lot.
Not a lot. We need social housing. I mean, affordable housing, as you say, is at the best 75% of market, which in a rich city with high property prices is simply not affordable huge number of people.
And where houses have actually got planning permission, some have been built, but they can't sell. The prices are so high.
Yeah, this is why we started council house building. Both the Lib Dem administration for me, who had planned it, and I pushed the building of council houses, which I think is the right way forward. So if we're going to if we're going to deal with these issues, we've got to stop selling council houses as well, which the right to buy, I think, has been extremely destructive. And it's been supported by both main political parties. But I know it's sort of drifting off the main subject here, but I think it is an absolute no-brainer that we should stop the selling of our very valuable social housing.
Well, I think it is the main subject, really, because we're talking about housing for everybody, and if the Western Harbour is only going to provide very expensive housing, that's not for everybody. No. Martin Summers, why are we in this situation here in Bristol where we've sort of gone cap in hand to Arup and said, please, will you come up with some nice plans that the developers would like to build in this part of the city, and then actually decided for ourselves, or Marvin Rees, the mayor, and his colleagues have decided, actually, we've decided that some of these options we're not going to even look at?
Well, I mean, you'd have to ask Marvin himself about why he's doing what he's doing. I mean, I'm learning an awful lot by hearing this conversation.
What about the way that this is very different, isn't it, to say 20, 30 years ago when city councils like Bristol were building housing, actually, high rises as well, at quite an amazing rate?
Well, I mean, the fundamental problem is what happened in the late 70s, early 80s. And it happened here and it happened in the United States, where we've got very well-established procedures for housing people and mixed developments. And we just threw them out the window. And then we didn't, when they had 13 years of Labour government, they didn't. This is absolutely extraordinary. They had 13 years in power and they didn't reverse any of this.
Well, at the other
which is why we've had a big battle in the Labour Party to change the leadership.
At the other end of the scale, which I in a way is every bit as interesting to me as the top end of the scale when it comes to housing, the council has revealed a new approach this week to van dwellers and tent villages in Bristol. This is Ellie Pipe writing in Bristol 24/7. A steep rise in the number of people living in vehicles and tents has prompted Bristol City Council to draw up a new official policy. Proposals seeking cabinet approval on Tuesday the 3rd of September are enforcement measures and the potential use of 12-month injunctions in locations considered vulnerable or adversely affected by high-impact encampments. Consultation into this apparently last year, and one of the things which many people asked for was to say that there should be some council services provided to homeless people and people living in tents and caravans, rather than just sort of trying to evict them, move them on. That there should be rubbish, you know, proper rubbish facilities, toilet facilities provided for tents and that sort of thing. But that's all been thrown out. Now, George, I hope you don't mind me asking you this, but I mean, we do need to do something, surely, about this people at the very, very bottom end, people forced to live in parks and things like this.
I think one of the things that really exercised me is that nobody would deal with the issue of interim housing solutions, because we have standards for housing and no officer wants to contemplate the idea of substandard housing. But actually, we do need container housing. We do need interim solutions. What we don't need is for those to become permanent solutions. And so I'm absolutely with that. I mean, here we have a council that's chasing people off the streets in their tents and caravans. On the other hand, they're not chasing off great advertising hoardings on trucks that are parked all over the place on bridges and semi-illegally in various sites in the city. I think we've got the priorities wrong. And I was for allowing a tent city, but I was persuaded against it by officers who said that this would be dangerous. But I think we need to work much closer with the various homeless charities in finding interim solutions that enable us to deal with the very poorest and those who are in a desolate state.
Mark, this effectively is a sort of a move them on solution. It really isn't. What they're saying is not that we can provide places for them to go, but is that they will just have to move when we tell them to move.
Yeah, I mean, I think we already know that just telling them to move doesn't work. I've got to say, just on this issue of the container housing, I was genuinely annoyed last week by the national media, who picked up on this idea of container housing and tried to turn it into a scandal. Whereas actually in Bristol, this has been a huge success. This has been led by homeless charities, and they have created this. It is temporary. It's temporary housing in, you know, clean containers that have been set up as nice, new, obviously very small and obviously very basic, but little houses that a lot of these people who are going into them are genuinely pleased to go into, and they are vastly better than smelly, mouldering, rotting little bed and breakfasts. The national media, for some reason, got the wrong end of the stick and went in Bull in China shop criticising the idea, you know, of people living in lorry containers, where it is going to have to be part of the solution, I think, in terms of we've got a lot of people who are, you know, on the streets homeless at the moment. They need transient and temporary housing.
Well, there are actually quite some rather trendy shops, aren't there, built in containers?
Oh, absolutely.
It can be done properly, but I mean, at the end of the day, what's happening, surely, and maybe Martin, I can bring you in on this. As world trade slows down with the trade wars, then there's suddenly a surfeit of containers. And people are wondering, well, what are we going to do with these containers? If we can turn them into temporary housing or turn them into shops, surely that's a good thing.
Well, I mean, if there is a major crash, and I suspect there is going to be, then you can start to think big about what you might do in response. And, of course, the prefabs were all built at the end of the war because there was a massive problems with housing people coming back from fighting.
Well, so a lot of housing had been bombed, didn't it?
Of course, it was a cheap and cheerful solution. And of course, people love those prefabs. I mean, you know, somebody I know used to live in one, and they were built with asbestos, so they had to knock them all down, and then they built new ones. And, there's nothing wrong with that kind of approach. I mean, we don't have to, you know, that's exactly what we need rather than the more luxury flats that nobody can afford.
George, what do you make of the idea of living in a container? Would you like to?
I'd be very happy to live in a container for a period, but I don't think I'd want to forever. But that's the whole point, is that I think, I've seen containers are absolutely beautiful inside. They're beautiful and they're there for people with a drastic housing need. It depends on the situation.
These injunctions, by the way, have been challenged in the courts in other parts of the country and thrown out on some occasions. So, but that seems to be the strategy the council's going for, is sweep it under the carpet. Is that what you would do if you were in charge?
Sweep what under the carpet?
The homelessness problem.
No, of course not. You've got to face up with it. And you've got to face up to it. It's one of the biggest problems. I've recently been in the States. I mean, it's an even bigger problem there. Mm. It is one of the essential issues. What's the point of being in politics if you're not going to deal with the most desperate situations? We are there in order to deal with those situations, not in any way to sweep them under the carpet.
Tackling encampments, say the council, and rough sleeping requires a holistic approach, which includes the use of enforcement activities and sometimes involves encouraging people to take up an offer that's not always their first choice.
Well, that is true. You can't give everybody their first choice. That is just simply impossible. And you can't just build out of the problem. I think, you know, this idea that somehow of course we've got to build more homes, but you will never catch up just trying to build your way out of the problem. We've got to think more laterally about it. I mean, what has caused an awful lot of homelessness and a shortage of homes is the way we now live. And in the way we've got to change the way we live in order to deal with the environmental aspects, we've also got to change the way we live in order to deal with some of the social aspects. And, I can point you to 3 and 4 generation families. And I think there's a huge benefit in people living in multi-generational families. And we need to have another look at that rather than just thinking we can build our way out of it. We will not do that, certainly within a decade and possibly not within 20 or 30 years.
Are there any groups, organisations, individuals you think in the city that really have thought this through and have got a policy that might work? Because it does sound as if this Western Harbour project is a little bit pie in the sky, and as you say, may never happen. But are there any people that you think have really got their heads around this?
Well, I think there are housing associations that are thinking fundamentally about it. I think, yes, there are many people who are thinking. Some of the political parties, to be fair, are thinking fundamentally about it. But I think this is not pie in the... I mean, this is just... what we are hearing is pure rhetoric, and there is always a danger in believing your own rhetoric. I know it myself. You can get very excited about something. We're hearing an awful lot of rhetoric nationally that where people are falling for their own words rather than
a lot of people say, George, reality. This is the mayoral system, really, that's caused this. Then if there was a much more cross-party system involved in these sorts of planning and development, and everyone, more of the political parties were involved in it, they would be able to carry the people of the city along much better than Marvin's done on his own. So they're saying this is really the mayoral system that's caused this.
Yeah, I campaigned for us having a mayor. It was the second best choice to us having a metro mayor. I think if you have a look at Greater Manchester, if you have a look at the West Midlands, they've got very effective metro mayors. We now have a metro mayor and a city mayor. I think they both weaken each other's positions. But you are right to the extent that it does, it leaves a lot of the good councillors out of the equation, out of the debate, out of the policy making. And I think, I was fortunate as an independent to be able to have a cross-party cabinet. So, I had a way into all the parties, and we had very sensible conversations across 4 parties. Now, when you get a single party domination, as we've got, The danger is that they just believe their own stuff all the time, and they're not properly questioned.
Well, the danger is, of course, as well, is that the mayor will just bring pliable people within his own party into his cabinet, and anybody that asks any questions in his own party even can be pushed out.
Yeah, and it's not just the politicians, it's also the apparatchiks, and I'm afraid the mayoral office has got a chief apparatchik who I see his hand on all this stuff.
This is Kevin Slocum, of which you speak.
You name him.
I couldn't possibly comment.
I couldn't possibly either.
Anyway,
no, it is. It's definitely Kevin Slocum who.
He's the sort of Alistair Campbell of the.
Well, I think you're being kind to him.
Okay.
I think he's more of a closer to Dominic
or who, Martin
Cummings. I think, yeah.
Or, okay, so before we say goodbye to you, George, I know you've got to go in a minute, but let's have a listen to Mark Weston. He's the Conservative leader in Bristol's response to I'm not sure what it was called. It was a big speech, anyway, a couple of months ago by the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, State of the City. Okay, so let's have a listen to that response from the Tory leader, Mark Weston, now to Marvin's setting out his plans, the Labour mayor, for the next year, including, of course, hopefully getting himself re-elected.
Now, the mayor is the elected leader of this city, and he has choices. He may be constrained by finances, but he still has those choices. He chooses to spend more money on his mayoral office. He chooses to spend more money on his cabinet. He chooses to spend more on the comms team. These are choices. He chooses to pour millions into the energy company. Again, choices. He also, by contrast, chooses to close toilets or cut parks budgets to threaten the libraries, which you've now U-turned and saved. He is choosing how to introduce parking charges at Blaise. These are all choices. Well, over the last 12 months, I've come to a different conclusion. I've made a choice. I've concluded that it's time for Bristol to have a choice. A choice on whether to carry on with the mayoral system to begin with. I believe that this system does not give democratic leadership. I believe it gives elected autocracy. And I don't believe that we should be continuing with it anymore. And I do not say this lightly. As you may remember, I campaigned for the system. But actually, after 7 years, I was wrong to do so. This is not helping Bristol. I have seen in the last 12 months, we've had the gerrymandering of the Constitution. We've seen that. So that it limits the scrutiny. We've seen the debacle over chief executive pay and all of the rest. We're going to discuss that later. Again, a choice, I might add. We've seen the debacle over the arena and the choice there to go from the city centre, put it out on the outskirts of the city. A choice made against the express wishes of the majority of this chamber and the majority of citizens. Now, if this, it was against the majority of this chamber, if that model had been made under the cabinet and leader system, then colleagues, I suspect you'd have made a choice too. Because I don't think a leader of a cabinet would have remained in office either after the arena or after the chief executive payout. I don't believe that at all. There were checks and balances in that system. There are none in this system at all. The Prime Minister position has more checks and balances than we have here in Bristol.
Yeah, that was a great speech by Mark Weston. I was there and I agreed with nearly all of it. It was good to hear the Tories come round to opposing the continuation of the mayor. The Lib Dems have always opposed it. We, when we were in the coalition government, got the law changed so that Bristol could have the choice after 10 years with a mayor to decide whether it wanted to continue.
So when are we going to get this choice, please, Mark?
Well, that will be... So our mayor candidate is running on the programme that she will attempt to sack herself if she gets elected. After 10 years with a mayor, which I think is 2022, we can bring forward to the city a local referendum to decide whether to stay with a mayor or to go back to the old system, or even, in fact, to change to what is called the old committee system. So our mayor candidate will do that. If she is mayor, she will bring that forward and effectively campaign for herself to be sacked.
Well, that doesn't sound like a great campaign platform.
Well, while she's mayor, she will have some policies. We'll have policies, obviously, on things like the Western Harbour and the arena and various other things like that. But her goal will be to serve only the one term and to abolish her own post.
Anyway, just sort of, just before you go, George, if we have, just have your reaction to this U-turn, really, from the Tories now saying, well, we think the mayor is a bad idea.
Well, it's always refreshing to hear politicians admitting they've changed their mind. I think the danger of politics is when people just doggedly stick to the same story all the time.
I mean, isn't this just and because... Actually, hang on, George, but isn't this really just because the Tories know this is a Labour city and they will never get their own mayor?
I mean, there may be an element of that. It doesn't take away the truth of what Mark Weston was saying. I couldn't hear all of it, but some of the spending priorities do seem very peculiar. And I absolutely agree with him that if you'd got a proper cabinet system, and particularly if you had a cross-party cabinet system, which we were promised by this mayor, but he took away, then he wouldn't have been able to drive through so many things that are plainly wrong.
Well, look, I mean, some people will criticise you, George, for your time when you were mayor, particularly with the port decision, the decision to sell the port, because various estimates of we should have been paid $1.3 billion for the port, and we got shortchanged for that. A lot of money potentially lost to the city because this was given to some merchant venturers. You know, I think it's Terence Mordaunt and David... Oh, crikey, I can't remember the names of both of them. But some people that you had been friends with at the Merchant Venturers. People might point to that decision as well to say, look, this is whole mayor thing is just no good.
They might. All that is complete rubbish. But anyway, the fact is we got probably almost 10 times the value of the residual value that you get between a long lease and a freehold. So in a way, that was free money, and there was a complete misunderstanding of that. And I had valuations done that were way below the $10 million that proper valuations done. So that was a bit of a nonsense.
But there was another thing.
But I understand. People thought that
because there was this Jones Lang LaSalle. Property services giant did that report, and then that again, that wasn't a bit like this thing we're seeing at the moment with this Arup report not being able to be seen by people. I think eventually people got hold of it through a Freedom of Information request. I mean, there must be a temptation on any one person to do things which are in their friend's interest rather than the city's interest as a whole.
Well, in fact, it's the complete opposite. If there was ever a suspicion that if there was ever a suspicion of something was being done from friendship, it would make me go in completely the opposite direction, because it would be absolutely stupid to give a better value to somebody that you knew than somebody you didn't know. So I think that that I still regard, as you know, a bit as a conspiracy theory, but let people think that. I'm not saying that everything I did was right. I'm not saying that you look a few years later and you might have done things in a different way. But I did everything that I honestly believed to be best for Bristol, and that's what I continue to do in my own way outside politics.
Anyway, George Ferguson, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll continue with Martin and Mark Wright. First of all, Martin, what do you make of this whole mayor thing? It looks like we may get a vote for it in 2022.
Well, I've always been opposed to mayors. I mean, I campaigned against having a mayor in the first place, and because Ken Livingston, when he ran the GLC in the 1980s when I lived in London, he was the leader of the Labour group, and he was answerable to the Labour group. And of course, you can form cross-party coalitions as well sometimes. But I think that's the parliamentary system, if you like. I think the whole thing about mayors was the Tories got it on the back of a fag packet from the Americans. And there's too much power in one person's hands. There's not enough checks and balances. It's just obvious, really.
Well, too much power in one person's hands is what they're now saying about Boris Johnson, because he's given all this power to a certain local MP called Jacob Rees-Mogg, who now, it seems, is going to actually prorogue Parliament.
Jacob Rees-Mogg is leader of the Commons. He helps run the business of the House. He's also a prominent supporter of Brexit. I spoke to him just a few minutes ago. I asked him, if suspending Parliament to make a no-deal Brexit easier is such a good idea, then why is the pound falling? falling, and why are currency speculators currently shorting sterling?
That simply makes investment in the UK more attractive because it makes it a better buy for foreign investors. But sterling moves about on the exchanges on a daily basis in accordance with passing news flows, whereas if you're looking at long-term investment, then I think the UK looks extraordinarily attractive.
Why is retaining no deal as part of the UK's negotiating strategy? Why is that important?
Well, it's an essential part of the strategy because you don't get a good deal if you say that you will accept any deal. That is a basic principle of any negotiation and is why the current withdrawal agreement is so unsatisfactory, that it essentially makes the UK a vassal of the European Union, or as Mr. Verhofstadt said, a colony of the European Union. So you have to go back to no deal and say, if we don't have a proper withdrawal agreement, we are happy to leave regardless, because that's what people voted for.
Well, as you know, the question of whether people voted for no deal or not is contentious. You're right, and others are right, that those who are saying what's been done now is a constitutional outrage would have difficulty pointing to any particular paragraph or clause in Britain's constitution which says that, because, of course, it's not written down. But that constitution does rely on trust, doesn't it? And bearing in mind that the majority, it seems, of your colleagues in Parliament don't want no deal, then that trust has been lost by this suspension of Parliament.
Forgive me for being pedantic, but the British Constitution is uncodified rather than unwritten, so you can't point to it in one place, but it is effectively written down in many different places, starting, if you wish, with Magna Carta. And so it's not quite as simple as that, as saying it's not written and therefore you can't point to anything. All the precedents are, every single one, is that this proposal to have a new Queen's speech was in line with the spirit and the practice of the Constitution, and that it's the normal operating of the Constitution. The only abnormality is that this session of Parliament has been so long. The outrage is, to my mind, completely phony, and it's from people who don't want to leave the European Union.
That may be true, but the idea of leaving the European Union is contentious, no question about that. It's unprecedented, and so to, in effect, shut down Parliament so that it can't debate that does break the position of trust. The government needs trust, it's not got it.
But Parliament isn't being shut down. About 4 or 5 days of parliamentary business will be lost because Parliament was going to be in recess anyway, so it's not this great loss of parliamentary time. And the outrage is phony is important, actually, because the people who are so cross at the moment are the ones who lost a vote. And actually, democracy requires people who lose votes to accept that they have lost the vote and get on with the new situation. We are leaving the European Union not because I want to or because Boris Johnson wants to, but because 17.4 million people voted that we should, and that was a comfortable majority.
Well, it was a majority of 4%, but let me come back to the point of trust. It wasn't a straightforward decision, wasn't it? It isn't a straightforward process. It's been very complex and very difficult to achieve. So Parliament should have its voice. And yes, OK, the extension is only a week, but it's already a limitation on Parliament's ability to check the government's policies and hold them to account.
I don't think it is a check on Parliament's ability, because Parliament would be sitting next week and into the week after. It will then be back just 1 week late in October from when was planned. It will then have a debate on the Queen's speech, which allows any issue to be raised. And then it will have the chance to legislate if any agreement is come to at the European Council, and will also be able to get on to the government's domestic agenda. So this is all going with the natural flow of events. Parliament will be able to vote and to legislate as it chooses, but it's already voted and, crucially, passed into law the departure from the European Union on the 31st of October.
Boris Johnson's government has one vote majority at the moment. What happens if this works out as you plan and the Queen's speech is given, and then your colleagues in the Conservative Party, who don't want no deal, decide they will vote down the Queen's speech, which they could do? What happens then?
That is a very interesting constitutional question to which I cannot give you an answer, because since the 2011 Fixed Term Parliament Act, the constitution has changed. Prior to that act, I could have told you precisely what would happen, but the waters on this are untested. My assumption is actually that nothing would happen, because the only vote of confidence nowadays is in accordance with the specific wording of the Fixed Term Parliament Act, and therefore defeat on any other parliamentary business is not a matter of confidence.
Is there any way, do you believe, that those who don't want no deal can stop the UK leaving on the 31st of October?
There are two ways. One is they can change the government, and the other is that they can change the law. How do they change the government? By a vote of confidence. If they can get that through, and if they can then agree on who should take over, that seems a long shot, because Mr. Corbyn doesn't have support to become leader. The other is to change the law, but the only effective way of changing the law is to say that we would stay in the European Union, and it seems to me that they lack the courage to say to 17.4 million people that they're going to ignore them. So I think it is very difficult to stop us leaving on the 31st of October.
Martin, what do you make of this decision? Some people are a bit apparently furious about it, others saying, well, this has been being talked about for months.
Well, it was being talked about for months by lots of cabinet ministers who said they would never do it and they didn't agree with it, but they've all decided that they're going to go along with it. Extraordinary, really. Michael Gove, for example, just as a for example, Matt Hancock, Amber Rudd, they all said we're never going to prorogue, and that's a silly idea. And Gina Miller actually approached the cabinet office last week and said, "Are you going to prorogue?" And they said, "No, that's just scaremongering. Don't worry about that." And then, of course, they were planning to do it all along.
So is the Queen. She's going along with it. The Privy Council too.
Well, it's all the
Scottish. Do you think they're twisting her arm or something?
Well, she's put in a very difficult position, isn't she? I understand this afternoon that the Scottish legal challenge has already fallen, but there's a legal challenge for Gina Miller's legal challenge, and there's also what's his name in Ireland?
Varadkar.
No, he's a local guy in Ireland.
Mark, what do you make of all this? The idea that, for a lot of people, they're looking at this saying, well, actually, Parliament, if they actually wanted to have a deal, they should have voted for Theresa May's deal. So they've got what they deserved here.
I mean, there's an element of truth in that, actually, to be fair. Theresa May had a deal that was a serious deal that could have been implemented. And I think, people who were imagining that there was some slightly better deal that they could have had were probably deluding themselves. I mean, on the issue of the prorogation, it's interesting to hear, that a lot of Tories are saying, well, this happens all the time. And it's true, it does happen all the time. But, the issue is the context of how critical that we are right now, just weeks away from a no-deal Brexit. It's a bit like someone who's just about to go in to have major liver surgery saying, well, I go out drinking all the time. What are you getting so upset for just because I've booked a heavy night out on the lash the night before my surgery? I mean, that's what we're talking about. The Prime Minister decided that now is the precise time to take a five-week break and then just to leave 4 days at the edge of the cliff to try and resolve everything. And it's perfectly obvious he's done it because he doesn't want Parliament to try and take control from him, either by throwing him out in a vote of no confidence or by coming up with an alternative to a no-deal Brexit.
We find ourselves in a rather peculiar position, Martin, of you aligning yourself with the likes of Oliver Letwin, who is one of the most avaricious privatisers this country's ever seen.
Well, and of course, if Hitler invaded us, we'd have to form a government of national unity, which is what we did in 1940.
Well, listen, no, Hitler is not invading us.
No, I'm just saying. No, I'm just pointing out that I believe in coalition. I believe in coalition politics.
Yeah.
I always believed in it. And that's because I'm a militant socialist, and I realise that my views are a minority view. And if I want to get anything done, I'm going to have to cooperate with others who aren't militant socialists.
So does that mean we don't do Brexit?
Well, what's going to happen here is one, for political analysts are going to be, we could argue about what various things, there's a huge flow diagram we could write on the wall here about the things that may happen now. But it's extraordinary that we've got to this very final hour with this extraordinary constitutional crisis, which probably is as big as 1919 when Sinn Féin won the 1918 election, or the glorious revolution of 1688, which is where your loyalists in Northern Ireland come from.
But we don't have a civil war on our hands, Mark.
Well, they have had a civil war on their hands for 30 years.
I think
lots of people were killed. Two Tory prime ministers were nearly assassinated.
Over-egging the pudding.
We did have
a referendum where we decided to leave. So the idea that we leave surely shouldn't be so controversial.
No, it's not, because the people, for example, who live in Europe, the British citizens who lived in Europe, didn't get to vote. That was a decision by the government not to let them vote. If they'd voted, we wouldn't necessarily have voted to leave. If you go on strike, you've got to get at least 50% of the people participating. Of that 50%, 50% plus vote to strike.
But
it's got to be 40%
Martin,
of the people balloted.
These strike laws you have been decrying for years.
The National Union of Mine Workers had an internal rule book which said that they wouldn't go on strike unless they had support of 55% of the membership. And in actual fact, when in the devolution referendum in Scotland at the beginning of the 1990s, they won. But they didn't win. They were told they had to win. They had to win 55% plus because it was such a big change.
Martin,
had to wait another 10 years.
Martin, do you suspect that Jeremy Corbyn is actually really a Brexiteer?
No, I don't think he is. He's a soft Brexiter. Once we'd passed it, I thought, well, if as long as we just go like Norway, so we're still in the single market, but we don't send idiots like Paisley and Farage at our expense to Europe, that'll be, in many ways, quite a useful thing to do.
But people vote for these so-called idiots, don't they?
Well, they do, and other people vote against them. And the question is, they haven't got the votes in Parliament. If we had a referendum or a general election, it's not clear they would win. They're putting forward a no-deal Brexit now, and if there will be
a
general election about a no-deal Brexit and they win, they can do what they want, but they haven't won that yet.
There may be a general election.
And it will be about no-deal Brexit.
Anyway,
if they don't get 50% plus one, it's not happening.
I thought we may as well go back to the 1970s to have a listen to a Labour Party guy who was very anti-EU campaigning against the common market. His name is Peter Shaw.
One thing which is wrong, of course, with this motion is that it says Europe. And what we are talking about is not some generalized consent to Europe. What we are asked to do is to say yes to a particular group of European nations and enter into, with them, a particular form of relationship, a particular contract, a particular treaty. And it is time that in considering this whole matter, we should put to ourselves the facts that the 8 countries of Western Europe, important as they are not even half of Western Europe itself, let alone the whole of the continent of Europe. Nor, for that matter, should we ignore the fact that there exists outside the continent of Europe altogether more European people or people of European origin in the great continents of North America, Latin America, and Australasia than there exists in the whole common market put together. And beyond that, we should recall the fact that our horizon and the concerns that we have in the world as a country and as a people are not limited to 8 nations and 200 million people in Western Europe, but to the 3,000 million people and the 140 nations that exist in the 6 continents of the world. And the policies that we pursue as a government, the causes that we follow as a people, the concerns that we have are not confined to and limited to this narrow area across the Channel. For that to happen to Britain would be a contraction and a reduction of all the things with which we have been concerned. It is the world that we belong to, and it is mankind of which we are part. So let us hear.
Martin, that's Peter Shaw there talking about joining the EU, which was actually done by Ted Heath, the Prime Minister, without any kind of vote. And then when Labour came along in the mid-1970s, they allowed the people to vote and they decided to stay in. But what he's saying is, wealth is already flowing out of this country, so it's not going to be good for us.
Well, Peter Shaw, it's a long time ago, of course. This was before the removal of exchange controls in 1979. When he was talking, you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country without permission from the government. And that wasn't Britain being... Britain was the same as everybody else at that stage. And so you could talk about having... When I did my interview at Oxford University in 1977, they asked me, what do you understand by the term siege economy? Because, of course, that was quite possible to do that at that stage. We could have nationalised everything. We could have had exchange controls, capital controls, so you can't take capital out of the country.
Okay, Martin,
but that's all gone.
A final question. Do you think that actually it could trigger a major crash? 5 seconds?
Brexit is a factor which is making the world economy even weaker than it otherwise would be.
Okay, thanks to our guests, Lib Dem councillor for Hot Wells and Harbourside Mark Wright, and independent former Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Join me after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.